This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 138 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Duke Johnson signed a three-year extension with the Browns last week, and I sent a harmless tweet noting that it wasn't a good thing for Nick Chubb's long-term fantasy football value. Because it's not. If you're a running back, having Duke Johnson on your depth chart is not a good thing for your overall production. Even still, I had some people hit my mentions with a typical, this actually won't do anything for Chubb because Chubb wasn't going to catch a lot of passes anyway. So I figured I'd kick this week's mailbag off with some context around this type of scenario. I don't disagree that there were pass-catching question marks around Chubb entering the league. But what I do think goes overlooked with these types of discussions is that when you've got competition versus not, generally speaking, the added competition is a bad thing for fantasy purposes. It limits upside. Let's just pretend that Duke Johnson is set to see 80 targets this year. Even if we assume the Browns would be a more pass-friendly team because Duke Johnson is on their roster, I think we can all agree that they won't simply throw the football 80 more times in a season because Duke Johnson is set to see 80 targets. Or to put this another way, if the Browns threw the ball 500 times with Duke Johnson, they're not going to throw the ball 420 times without Duke Johnson. Maybe they throw it 480 times, but all of those targets aren't being generated simply because they have Duke Johnson. So when Duke Johnson leaves the picture, that means there's some volume that's up for grabs. It may not be 80 targets because the Browns' philosophy may change, but it's highly unlikely that it's completely altered. Maybe those 80 targets become 60 in this Duke Johnson-less offense. That means 60 targets are now being dispersed across all pass catchers on that team. Like, let's just be really simple about this. Do you really think that Nick Chubb wouldn't benefit from that? Of course he would. Of course Nick Chubb has more general upside without Duke Johnson in that offense. Just because you didn't expect Nick Chubb to be much of a pass catcher doesn't mean Chubb would see zero targets no matter the circumstance. I mean, look at Jordan Howard as the perfect example of this. Howard saw 50 targets during his rookie season when he started just 13 games and played in just 15 games. Last year, he saw 32 targets, or 18 fewer targets, in 16 games. And all the while, Chicago threw the ball to their running backs in 2017 48 more times than they did in 2016. Yes, it's because of Tariq Cohen's presence, but that's also the point. The Bears utilized their backs more in the offense, but Jordan Howard still saw a significant decrease in targets. This is why Darius Geis with Chris Thompson is a lot worse from a fantasy standpoint than Darius Geis without Chris Thompson. Chris Thompson is going to be used as a pass-catching back. And when Thompson's on the field catching passes, that means Darius Geis won't be. And the last time I checked, you can't score fantasy points from the sideline. I'm just always kind of blown away by how people sometimes make things far more complicated than they need to be. When a team adds a usable player to its offense, especially at running back, that's not a good thing for the existing players in that offense who are fighting for volume. Yeah, maybe those players will see an uptick in efficiency, but give me the difference in volume over that difference in efficiency all day long. Volume is what drives the game of fantasy football. Do not lose sight of that. Anyway, today is a mailbag day, but before we dig in, I wanted to let you know about a cool new game over on FanDuel. The U.S. may not be playing in the World Cup, but that doesn't mean you have to ride the bench. Play World Soccer Pick'em on FanDuel every day of the tournament starting June 14th and compete for the daily jackpot and free entries. It's simple. Before each day's action begins, just pick the outcome and the final score of every match. Get all the outcomes right to win a free play entry. Hit the scores and you'll snag a share of the daily cash jackpot. If you want to play for even bigger cash prizes, FanDuel has plenty of regular fantasy soccer contests running all tournament long too. To play World Soccer Pick'em, head to FanDuel.com/Pick'em. That's FanDuel.com/Pick'em. All right, now let's get to these questions. This first question is from Twitter from @EggersK. Help me understand Rashad Penny's fourth round ADP, which has a rookie with question marks behind a bad O-line led by a bad offensive coordinator. I personally think you, and he means you as in JJ because I asked him, put too much weight into college production and draft stock rather than focus on offensive system, but don't have data to fully counter-argue. Eggers K is coming in hot with questioning the hashtag process. I love it. I actually would argue that I'm someone who focuses far less on college resume when looking at how these players will transition in year one and beyond in the NFL. I've been on record many times saying that situation can trump all the research that we've done on prospects. The most obvious example is Alvin Kamara. I didn't love Alvin Kamara entering the NFL. I thought he was a super high variance prospect. But he landed in New Orleans and everything changed. My outlook on Alvin Kamara changed completely and immediately. You can go back and listen to shows in April and May of last year to hear how that changed. New Orleans is and was the perfect landing spot for Alvin Kamara's skill set, and it's a situation that's just vomited useful fantasy running backs. I'm not patting myself on the back there, I'm just trying to provide an example to defend myself here. There'll be plenty of times where I don't accurately predict a situation, but I do think that I probably care more about situation than a lot of other analysts out there. Now, after Eggers K sent me this message on Twitter, there was a follow-up that said, "Not saying Penny won't have RB2-ish value this season, but he seems to have lower ceiling and lower floor compared to other running backs near his ADP, like Kenyon Drake, Alex Collins, Derrick Henry, Sony Michel, Darius Geis, Deion Lewis, Royce Freeman, etc." I just simply disagree from a situation standpoint here. Let's just go player by player among the backs that you just listed. Kenyon Drake doesn't have a huge body of work as a workhorse, and he's in a bad offense. Alex Collins came from literal nowhere last year. What if he doesn't maintain his play this season? And it's not like the Ravens' offense is going to be very good. Derrick Henry has Deion Lewis to worry about, and Deion Lewis has Derrick Henry to worry about. Henry may steal touchdowns, and Lewis may steal targets. Sony Michel is in a backfield that rotates its running backs often, and he's sharing one with one of the better pass-catching backs in the league. And so is Darius Geis. And then Royce Freeman has some competition, and he's playing with a below-average quarterback starter. This doesn't mean that I'm automatically selecting Penny above all of those players. I just think that you've got to be real with your evaluations to see that there's plenty of downside all over the place in the location where Penny's being drafted. And I also think that Penny has just as much, if not more, realistic upside than the guys that you just listed, given the fact that many of those players have true pass-catching backs on their roster. So if you're in a PPR format, that's going to hurt those players. That just ties into what I just talked about in the intro. To me, Seattle's offensive line should be better this year, and it was better last year when they got Dwayne Brown. And while I think Schottenheimer is a bad coordinator, we also know that the team will want to run the football. That may limit overall scoring opportunities, but it also increases the number of touches that Rashad Penny might see. Maybe you're afraid of Chris Carson given what people are saying about him here in June, but I still have a very hard time believing the Seahawks would draft a first-round running back just to see him in a committee role. Though, to be fair, a team that has holes like Seattle has, drafting a first-round running back does show us that they're not the most competent team in the NFL. Overall, though, I think that he's in a similar spot as a lot of those other players, if not a better one. You may not see that, and that's okay, but it's odd to call him out specifically when comparing him to other players at his ADP who also have plenty of question marks. And you see that? I just answered that question without even mentioning his dope college production profile. This next question is from Twitter from @Tubaca. "Thanks for your insights, JJ. I'm wondering whether you think Russell Wilson's production will take a significant hit this year with a new Seattle offensive coordinator. Thanks." Russell Wilson is due for regression regardless of the coordinator. He had a 6.1% touchdown rate last season, and as I mentioned last week, the Seahawks had the highest passing touchdown to rushing touchdown ratio that we've seen over the last 7 years. Those numbers are bound to regress, especially given he has fewer weapons now. And Seattle wants to be a more run-heavy team, which definitely won't help. So I think that Russell Wilson is an easy fade in fantasy drafts, given he's going to be a fairly early-ish round guy. This next question is an email. It says, "Hey JJ, what players are you especially down on heading into the year that are presenting some red flags for you? I would think Joe Flacco would be one with Jackson behind him, not that he is anybody to draft, but would you also be hesitant to take Gronk considering the retirement and trade rumors? The entire Miami offense, Leonard Fournette? Thanks, Jeremy in Texas." Yeah, it's obviously still early, but I generally am going to be low on early round players who are in bad offenses. So LeSean McCoy is one player that I'm a little bit nervous about when looking at the first couple of rounds of fantasy drafts. I do think that he has an opportunity to get by on volume alone, but that's still a little scary considering he'll be 30 years old next month. I'm also still nervous about Kenyon Drake. He was really good last year when given the opportunity, so it's not like I'd be shocked if he performs well in 2018. But the Dolphins' offense may not be very strong this year, and they brought in a little competition for Drake with Frank Gore and rookie Kalen Ballage. Drake was never a high-volume rusher in college, so our sample size on Kenyon Drake is super small, and that makes me see him as overvalued in the fourth round only because there's a lot of downside to his situation. Like, we're not talking about a questionable situation in a good offense. We're talking about one in a Ryan Tannehill-led offense. So again, it's not that I can't see the allure with Kenyon Drake. to me, it's just a balancing act of upside and downside. And in the fourth round, I'd probably rather take a shot at one of the rookie backs like Penny or Geis, who are in better overall offensive situations. I talked about Brandon Cooks on last week's mailbag, and I think that he's another guy where his ADP is a little bit high as well. Those are just a few who jumped into my head when looking at this question, but I'll probably have wildly different answers in a month or so. That's what happens when we get more information. Our thoughts should change. This next one is quite a long one, but I think it's pretty interesting. It says, JJ, I know you've spoken about Le'Veon Bell's contract previously, but I would love your take on comparing Jarvis Landry's contract to what Bell is demanding on behalf of running backs. Landry's roughly a $16 million per year player, while Bell will be lucky to earn $30 million between last season and the upcoming year. Yes, it's a passing league, and yes, wide receivers are currently getting paid. And yes, Cleveland had cap and cash to burn. But Bell is such a talent, I reckon he could literally transition to become a productive slot receiver. Could he then get paid what Landry is? Bell does far more for his offense, on the ground and in the air combined, compared to what Jarvis Landry offers on offense. And I'm not sure you could use the because there are fewer good receivers answer here, because there are only a small handful of running backs in Bell's ballpark. The dream, ultimately, across all industries is to work less and get paid more. So maybe Bell should just become a slot receiver? And then he says, I'm just playing devil's advocate here in a tongue-in-cheek way, so I hope you get my point. But maybe not really? Phil from Sydney, Australia. Okay, I talked about the value of a running back earlier in the offseason. I think the one thing that we've got to sort of push through our minds as fans is that what most running backs do on the ground is replaceable. I'm not talking about the efficiency of Alvin Kamara or even what Todd Gurley did a season ago. But when you look at something like an expected points formula, which to me at least gives you some way to compare the impact of rushing to receiving, there's really not a significant difference between the best players on the ground to replacement level ones. And actually, guys, you can just look at raw statistics if you really want to. Yards per carry rates just aren't going to deviate much from one another. They'll be in the 3-5 range almost always. And at the team level, the difference between the best team in yards per carry to the worst one last year was 1.3 yards. The difference in passing was 2.5 yards per attempt. That's a super simplistic way to just show you that each time you run, you're not only gaining fewer yards than a pass, but your potential edge in being a really good running team versus a really good passing team isn't as large. Le'Veon Bell is a good runner, and I do think that there's something to be said about a player who can shoulder the kind of workload that Le'Veon Bell sees. But realistically, throwing a replacement-level running back in the Steelers' backfield wouldn't see a dramatic dip in rushing production. I'm not saying James Conner would just match Le'Veon Bell's production on the ground, but it's not going to make or break the Steelers' season by any means. We even saw that when an aged D'Angelo Williams stepped in for Le'Veon Bell. Like, the Steelers have actually averaged more points with D'Angelo Williams than with Le'Veon Bell since Le'Veon Bell entered the league. Therefore, when you say something like Bell does far more for his offense, that may be true, but it's certainly not a lock if his rushing production is pretty easily replaceable. This is why you can't just look at something like total yards from scrimmage in order to draw a conclusion in football. Because all that's doing is looking at volume and usage. It's no different than saying, this person made $800 cutting their neighbor's lawns last month, while this other person made $300 for creating a new logo for a brand, therefore the person cutting the neighbor's lawns is more valuable. Just because the one person made more money doesn't make their overall job more valuable. That person probably had to work a lot more to get the $800 with their lawnmower, and a lot of people also know how to cut grass. It's easy to find an alternative. Not many people know how to do graphic design. That's why you can charge more per hour than you can for manual labor for cutting grass. This is legitimately no different. If you can find an alternative rusher, then that piece of the position becomes far less valuable and, in turn, less costly. So then what about receiving? Well, we have no idea what Le'Veon Bell would be like as a high-volume slot wideout. We know that Jarvis Landry is better than his counterparts at the position, but we have no idea what Le'Veon Bell would be. So could he demand what Jarvis Landry just received? I don't really think so, because we don't know what kind of player Bell would be if he was strictly a wide receiver. I understand that this is dumbing it down a bit, but I think that that's really the only way to get the point across. There are unmeasured advantages to having a player like Le'Veon Bell. But I also think it's very easy to always overrate these unmeasured advantages. It seems like any time I have a conversation about running back value, people point to things like defenses playing for the run or the creation of mismatches. Like, I get it, those things can happen. But let's put some proof to this. Let's not just state that that happens, let's see the impact of it happening. Like, I think that pass blocking is a really good example. Player X is a good pass blocker, but player Y sucks as a pass blocker. Therefore, the impact that player X has is much greater than player Y on a football field. Okay, but what's the actual impact? What's the difference between a replacement level pass blocker and one who's really good at it? And is the trade-off worthwhile when there are other things that running backs do? We can't overemphasize one aspect of the game just because it makes an argument more convenient. And I'm not saying that you are, Phil. I think your question is super, super valid. Part of it is because you could argue the Browns overpaid, but the other part is that there are things that aren't being measured that Le'Veon Bell provides for the Steelers offense. But there are a lot of things that are being measured that show that running back production is very replaceable in today's NFL given the nature of the position and the amount of people on this earth who can play it well. So my answer to your question is that wide receivers are getting paid because they're enhancing the thing in today's NFL that can give you the most dramatic edge offensively, and that's having an efficient and effective passing attack. You can get to that point a lot of different ways, but having good wide receivers at least helps you get there. We'd have to see if Le'Veon Bell can actually provide that value before throwing out a crazy contract to him, because what he does on the ground is realistically not overly significant. If he were a really good wide receiver, though, he definitely would be in better shape to make more money than being an elite running back. And that's the way it should be for most running backs in general. This next question says, "Hey JJ, loving the summer podcast. It's super helpful learning about process rather than just focusing on which players to put into my roster each week. Thanks." My question is about taking advantage in the draft of someone's inherent bias. In my league, the resident Lions fan has selected Matthew Stafford in the 7th round for each of the last 4 seasons. Obviously, as a loyal late round quarterback acolyte, I would never take a quarterback that early, but should I consider taking Stafford with the pick before our Lions fan in order to use him as trade bait after the draft? Am I overthinking it and risking him resisting my subsequent trade overtures when I should just focus on my own strategy? Thanks as always for the help, Liam. You can draft with the intent to trade if the value is there. But what you're doing is drafting with the intent to trade when the value isn't there. Like if you had Golden Tate, but for whatever reason Marvin Jones was available in the 14th round, you should still draft Marvin Jones because he's super, super valuable there. But here, you're basically reaching for a player only because you think you might be able to extract more value after the draft. Don't do that. That owner could decide that they don't want Stafford, or they may not even give you a worthwhile deal because they ended up getting a very viable quarterback late. Don't draft just to trade when you're drafting suboptimally. It's a losing strategy. This next one is from Twitter. It's from @KeithWaters. Who is the rookie wideout most likely to produce right away and or long term? I'm not really high on any rookie wideout here in year one, but I think that Anthony Miller may be my pick to produce most right away. He'll have a role in the slot in the Bears offense from the start, and that should allow him to see decent enough volume, especially in the context of what other rookie wideouts are going to see. But DJ Moore is still my favorite from this class. I don't expect him to necessarily be the best wide receiver during this rookie season, but I do think that it wouldn't be shocking if he saw a bigger target share than most are projecting for him in the Panthers offense. So short-term, Anthony Miller, long-term, DJ Moore. That's it for today's show, though. Thanks again for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And when you're on iTunes, do me a favor and leave me a rating and review. I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Follow me on there for some awful, awful takes. Thanks again, everyone. I'll talk to you next week.